Okay, so hi everybody online. Good to see you. I'm Bande Sujato and joining you for this beautiful Friday night here in Sydney on the land of the Burramundigal people of the Darug Nation, to whom we pay our respects and we remember their custodianship of this land. For us here in Sydney, it is, well, actually for monastics all around the world, it is the Katina season. Which means usually that means that you spend 3 months cultivating seclusion and meditation and then spend 3 weeks to throw it all away. That's usually how that goes. See, you can see all the monastics are laughing because they know how true that is. Anyhow, usually not, I'm a little bit cynical here, but not quite that bad anyway. So for tomorrow, we're having our robe offering ceremony. So I'll talk more about the Katina and so on at that event tomorrow. So that's for those people in Sydney, and that's at the, what is it, Gorleston Community Centre tomorrow. So come along tomorrow morning around 10 or something like that. If you're in Sydney, if you're not in Sydney, you can probably still book a flight. Look forward to seeing you. Dylan, are you coming down? Or is it too far? She's not coming down. Oh, bloody hell. We're missing you here. You're too far away. Actually, I did a retreat in Bowral not long ago, so actually should have seen you then, but I forgot to say hi anyway. At the Harzer Park? That's where I was last week when I wasn't here. Yeah. Okay. So what happened to Eka?
Oh, he's just.
He just disappeared in the loop. Okay. Somebody just came and then they just vanished. So I don't know. So while we're just waiting for, and there are a couple of other people we know are parking their cars, we're just waiting for them. I'll just ramble on and just say hi to some folks online. Esther, how are you going? Yeah, life is going okay in Vienna? Yeah, yes, true Buddhist equanimity there. Congratulations. Christian, good evening. How are you?
I'm good.
I'm good. I don't know. Have we met?
Yeah, we met in Norway.
In Norway. Oh, okay. Oh, okay. Well, welcome. And
Thanks.
how's Norway going?
It's going okay.
Cold?
Not so cold yet.
Not so cold. Okay, very good. Yeah. Oh, well, look, good to see you coming along. And how's practice been since you finished the retreat?
Very sloppy.
Very sloppy. Well, what I can hear from that is your honesty. So you're speaking very humbly and honestly about your practice. So that's an admirable quality. So let's see if we can. Let's see if we can move things along a little bit. All right. Okay, so let's begin with chanting the homage to the Triple Gem. Do we need any chanting sheets? Rachel, do you need a chanting sheet? No, you good? Okay.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang saranang gacchami. Dhammang saranang gacchami, Sanghang saranang gacchami, Dutiyampi Buddhang saranang gacchami, Dutiyampi Dhammang saranang gacchami, Dutiyampi Sanghang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi buddhang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami. Iti piso bhagava arahang sammā sambuddho vidya charana sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhamma sarati satha deva manusanam buddho bhagavati svakato bhagavata dhammo sandirthiko akaliko ehipasiko opanayiko pachatam veditabo vinyuhiti supatipanno bhagavato sahavakasangho ujupatipanno bhagavato sahavakasangho nyayapatipanno bhagavato sahavakasangho samichipatipanno bhagavato sahavakasangho yadidam chattari purisa yugani atha purisa pungala esa bhagavato sahavakasangho ahuneyo pahuneyo dakhirneyo anjali karaniyo anutarang punyaketang lokasati.
Okay, very good. Excellent. Oh, hey, Shani, welcome. So, welcome to the Venerables at Dhammasara. I can see that Venerables there. When's your katina? Have you had your katina yet? Already? Okay, very good. And it went okay? Okay, who got the katina robe? Who? Sorry. Ah, I can't even see. Venerable. Oh, really? Venerable Achala got the katina robe. That's awesome. Well deserved. So usually in the sorry. Your voice is very quiet, Venerable. I can't hear you. Oh, really? Oh, those guys sewed it. Amazing. So if when we do the katina ceremony, then Sangha is supposed to sew a robe and then we give it to one monastic, and that monastic is usually we choose like the number one. Hey. We choose like the number one monastic to give it to, right? So it's usually whoever's the best, whoever wins at the, you know, like the Mr. Bhikkhu competition or Miss Bhikkhuni competition or whatever you have is like gets the robe. Okay, fine. Hi, everyone. Sorry, I'll try to stop being silly at some point. Well, probably not anytime soon. Okay, so now time has come to do some meditation. Would you like to do some meditation? Yes. Who doesn't like meditation? Well, the other like 4 million people in Sydney who are not here, obviously. So we're going to do some practice today. And as usual, I'll say a few words about meditation and then we'll do a guided meditation together. And last week we had Venerable Prasanna was here. So I'm sure that they led a very nice meditation for you all. I was away leading a retreat with ABCAP, the Buddhist and Psychotherapy Group. And congratulations to Venerable Achala for 10 vasa. Really? Venerable. I don't even know what to say. 10 vasa is a lot. Like if you think that one vasa, like when you first ordain, you ordain is like one vasa, and you think, wow, look at those ones who've got like three vasa. They must really know what's what. And then you got 10 vasa, and then you realize I still don't know what's what. Anyway. So one of the key ways that we introduce Buddhism through teaching and through practice is through the practice of meditation. And meditation is something which unites us all. Meditation brings us all together, mainly because we're all bad at it. Right? So that's at least something to share. So one of the things I try to teach when I'm teaching meditation is I one of the key moments in my meditation practice and how I approach meditation teaching happened when I was staying in a monastery called Phujamkom, which is on the very easternmost tip of Bangkok. And I had an adventure. Phujamkom is a very adventurous place. It's a national park, and there's a lot of wilderness. Our kutis were like an hour's walk away from the main sala. You'd walk up and down this mountain to get there. When we say mountain, I mean, it wasn't a very big one, but you still have to walk up and down. Beautiful place, stunningly beautiful, the most beautiful place I've ever stayed in, certainly in Thailand, probably anywhere. And I loved staying there, but it was pretty rugged. Anyway, one time, I did my knee in while I was staying there, tripped over a long and somewhat hilarious but unnecessary story behind that. Anyway, tripped over, and I spent the whole rains retreat having like really looked forward to wanting to practice and do a lot of meditation, a lot of walking meditation, sitting meditation, and then suddenly I found that I couldn't even walk. I had to walk on crutches and these kinds of things. So that was a hassle, obviously a bit despondent because of that, and tried to do the best that I could. At one point in that rains retreat, I read a book by Ajahn Lee Dhammadaro, who's one of the Thai forest tradition teachers. He was the teacher of Ajahn Tanisro, who many people will be familiar with. Ajahn Lee had a particular way of teaching meditation. And I don't know what it was. I mean, these things are not rational. I don't know what it was. But I just read this little book, which I read before, and honestly, it wasn't anything. Like, it wasn't anything that I hadn't read 100 times before. It was just a book on how to meditate. But something about the way that he talked about meditation made it seem like it was possible. It made it seem like, oh, yeah, I can do that. And I just read that little book, and then I went up to the Dhamma Hall and then sat meditation and had a really nice meditation. Just because something clicked in my mind, rather than saying, woe is me, blah, 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 I can't do all these things. After that rains retreat, I remember I went back to Bangkok and visited my metta teacher, Ajahn Mahachatchai. And he said, how was your rains retreat? And I said, well, not as good as I'd hoped, because I did my leg in, I couldn't meditate as much as I wanted to. So I read some suttas and did some study and I did some meditation. And he said, you should never regret the time that you have to listen to or study the Buddha's teachings. Even maybe you wanted to do meditation more, but to be able to have the blessing to be able to study the Dhamma is something that's incredibly profound and very powerful. So don't ever regret that, or don't think lightly of it. It will come back to you when you need it. So this is something that I remember, and that book by Ajahn Lee, I can't even remember what the name of the book was. It's just it created a kind of a trigger in my mind that like when the conditions are there, and then when we think we can do it, then we can do it, basically. So when we're approaching meditation, I think it's really important to reflect on the narrative that we use when we're describing meditation. It's almost always the same. right? Say to people, how's your meditation going? Oh, yeah, mine's wandering. Oh, blah, blah. I'm not going to go with it. Right? So this is a story that people are telling themselves in their meditation. Sorry, a story that people are telling themselves about their meditation, right? So I always want to try to flip the script on that. So when you say to me, my mind is always distracted, what you're telling me is that you now have the wisdom to know that your mind is always distracted. Because it was distracted beforehand, you just didn't notice it. Right? So you want to try to flip that script. One of the things that I did on this recent retreat, we did the meditation interviews. Always on a retreat, the most important part is the meditation interviews. We're doing mindfulness and breathing for this retreat. And in the interviews, I asked every meditator, you know, they come in and talk about this and talk about that and so on. And then I would ask them, what does your breath feel like? Right? Seemingly a simple question. I'm going to go out on a limb and say 80% of the people on that retreat did not answer that question. 80%. Certainly the clear majority. What does your breath feel like? Does it feel soft? Does it feel harsh? Does it feel slow? Does it feel nice? No. They went and talked about something. Talked about some theory or something. And I sometimes would do it two or three times. Yes, but what does your breath feel like? And it was really hard to get people to actually notice what their breath feels like. But this is the key to mindfulness of breathing meditation. What does your breath feel like? Your breath always has a certain tone to it, a certain texture, a certain feeling. And so when we're breathing, we enter into that feeling. Like initially, you feel that feeling as something which is kind of separate, like you're here, you're observing, and you can feel the breath or something a bit separate. But the deeper you go into meditation, the more your mind is reflecting the feeling and the texture of the breath. It's like how meditation works. Your mind and the breath are starting to echo each other. The breath becomes more peaceful, the mind becomes more peaceful. The breath becomes more smooth, the mind becomes more smooth. And these are the qualities and the properties of the breath that we experience in meditation. So when we're meditating, we're not worried about meditation theory. We're not worried about what's the right way to practice. We're not worried about how far we're getting. We're not worried about, am I a good meditator? Am I a bad meditator? We're not worried about, am I sitting in the right posture? We're not worrying about, oh my God, I hope I don't have a goofy grin on my face. Everyone's going to laugh at me or anything like that. We're not worried about those things. The only thing that we're being aware of is the feeling of the breath. What does the breath feel like? And the more that we can bring attention to that with empathy and with care, then the more we will find that the breath and the mind are mirroring each other and entering into each other. Sorry, my phone is not off. Give me a minute to... Where's my flight mode? Anyway, okay, hopefully that won't happen again. Okay, fine. All right, should we do some meditation? Yes? Great. If you like, it's a bit hot though. What do you think? I think just leave it, it's not too loud outside. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. And when your mind starts wandering off thinking about this and that, just be aware of it. Ah, okay. All right. That's what minds do. And bring the mind back to the breath and let the cool energy of the breath calm you down. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out.
And then feel the breath becoming softer, sweeter. Soothing you. So noticing how the breath is becoming so soft that it almost seems sometimes that it disappears, stilling first the roughness of the breath goes. You can feel the silky smoothness of it. And then even that smoothness becomes more and more and more subtle, fading away. Now coming to the end of the meditation, taking a minute to reflect back and ask ourselves, what just happened? How did the mind change? How does the mind feel now compared to how it was at the start of the meditation? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings find freedom and peace. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, very good. Okay, let's have a break for a couple of minutes. Come back for some Dhamma talk. Hey. All right, so we're just kind of talking about that now, but I'm moving house at the moment, and so I wanted to give a bit of a Dhamma talk about moving house. Who here has moved house? Yes, everyone moves, right? And there was a film, I think, when I was young, that they did a film about moving house, and the removalist was this philosopher who said that the three most stressful events in life is death, divorce, and moving house. So I must say, okay, I'm feeling pretty good, right? Because, well, I'm a monk, so divorce is not really on the table. Number two, moving house, well, it's not too bad, you know. If you're a monastic, then moving house is okay, you know. It's still a bit stressful and there's still things to do, but it's not too bad. With the help, of course, of many people who are making it possible. Anyway, I just thought I'd sort of, because when I was thinking about that, there's quite a number of different ramifications and so on in the Dhamma, and I was thinking about, like, all the different places that I've lived in my life. Like, we tend to live in quite a lot of places these days, right? I was born in Perth. I lived in Manning. Don't remember my first house at all. And then we went to Mount Lawley. We had a big backyard with a fig tree in it. And then to Atterdale, near the river. It's nice. And then we went to Claremont and Crawley. And then I went to my first place outside of my home. That was in North Perth, $27 a week. Wow. Yeah. What has the prices gone up since then, have they? $27 a week. That was like a front room in a detached house in an inner city neighborhood.
Is that in the 80s, London?
Sorry?
In the 80s? Or
it was in the 80s, yeah. 80s. Yeah. Anyway. So the next place I stayed was even cheaper. Yeah, because that was staying with, I shacked up with my girlfriend, whose place was paid for by her parents, who didn't know that I was staying there. Shh. So that was also, it was good also. Then another place with another friend, Thisbe in Northbridge. Then I went to Sydney. I stayed in Bronte and Maroubra. Then I went to Brisbane. I stayed in West End. Back to Sydney. Stayed in Colcliffe. In Brisbane? You know Brisbane? Yeah, funky. Yeah, West End's funky. Most of the places I stayed in were funky. Then I went to Thailand, and I ended up at the monastery, of course. I ended up in Wat Nanachat in northeast Thailand, Ubonachitani, Ban Bung Wai. Stayed there for a few years and on and off going to different branch monasteries. I stayed at a branch monastery called Phujom Kom, I mentioned before. That's where I had that encounter with Ajahn Lee's teachings. Phujom Kom, stunning place. I stayed 3 rains retreats there. The first rains retreat, I stayed in a cave that was like halfway down the cliff, or like part of the way down the cliff. And there's just like a little bamboo bed there that I stayed on. And that was awesome. I loved that. It was really good. There are a few challenges if you're staying in a place like that. Like occasionally, like a snake will fall on your head while you're walking meditation from the cliff above. But not like it's not like a regular occurrence, okay? Just occasionally that might happen. But beautiful. Yeah, that did happen to me, yeah. Yeah. Well, it didn't bite me. Was it poisonous? I mean, probably.
Red belly or brown?
Well, it's in Thailand. Probably a crate, maybe, or a Russell's viper.
I don't know. Anyway, my friend Siripanyu was walking down from the mountain one day. There was in the path, there was a tree had fallen down the path, and he stepped over the tree, and then it slithered out from underneath his feet in the early morning light. Oh my goodness! He came down and he told the people in the villagers that he'd seen this huge python on the path. And they asked him, where did he see it? What time did he see it? What color was it? And then they said, we're afraid to say it wasn't a python, that was a king cobra. Oh. So, yeah, anyway. So, stayed there for a while, a few different places in Thailand. Then what happened? Oh, then I went back to Bodhnyana, back to Perth again. I discovered that my hometown, that there was a monastery. So I went to Bodhnyana, stayed with Ajahn Brahm. And then from there to Malaysia, stayed in Ipoh. Anyone from Ipoh here? No? You guys not from Ipoh? Family from Ipoh? Anyone from Ipoh? No? Anyway, stayed in Ipoh, stayed in Penang. Then where? Oh, then to Thailand, to Northern Thailand, to Nan, back to Phnom Penh, then to Bundanoon, stayed at Santi Monastery. Yay! Then Chittabhavana Hermitage. I renamed it Santi Monastery because Chittabhavana was a few too many syllables for Australians, okay? So Chittabhavana is just like too many. I'm sorry. Ajahn Brahm chose that name, and so I'm like, no, I'm sorry, we'll call it Santi. That's nice. It's only two. And it sounds like sandy, which is a beach, and Australians know about beaches, so that should be good enough. So I stayed there for nearly 10 years, then left, was wandering around a bit at Bodhnyana and a few other places, ended up in Chimei in Taiwan for 3 years, translating, back to Australia, to Harris Park, and now to Parramatta, my new place. So that's a life in wanderings, I guess, and all the different places. I've been to other places as well, but that's the main ones. And, you kind of, there's a kind of a rhythm to moving, you tend to shed things when you move, and you tend to accumulate things when you stay, right? You're like a ship growing barnacles, and the longer you stay, the the more the barnacles will accrue. So there's something freeing in that idea of moving, right? So even though maybe it's stressful, but there's something freeing. And one of the defining things about monastic life is life gone forth, right? Go forth and live and wander. And there was something in what the Buddha did, which was very, really kind of freeing, just like walk out and just wander down. I always had this kind of fantasy, most monasteries I've stayed in, I'd reach one point of frustration where I just want to take my bowl and my robes and walk out the door and just walk down the road. Just leave everything behind. I never quite did it, but I really wanted to a couple of times. I should have done. I'm too old now. Well, now I'm staying with myself, so the only person to get frustrated with is me, and I'll be there when I leave anyway, so it's not really much point. But there's something like really freeing about that, I don't know. I feel like we live in a world now that's very mapped. You can't get lost particularly. And there's even if you go to a national park or something, there's signs and there's pathways and things are marked. And so we sort of miss, I think, that freedom of just having like an openness. So the Buddha wandered across India, stayed in different ashrams, stayed in different places. But of course, it didn't take long for the Buddha also to settle down. And in shortly after he ordained, he accepted the first monastery. It was in the Welawana in Rajagaha, and allowed for Sangha to stay in one place. Arguably, that was the beginning of the end, right? That was the beginning of the decline in the Sangha. But, you have to do it, right? There's the kind of idea of like wandering and so on is great, but it rains. It's pretty hard, actually. Like wandering along, like not staying anywhere, it's pretty hard. When it rains, it's bad. And then there's like ants and leeches and elephants and ghosts and all kinds of things which are lurking. So, yeah, it's not easy. It's not an easy life. So that kind of tension between that settled life and the life gone forth has always kind of been apparent in Buddhism and in the Sangha. Like you have a kind of contrast between the village-dwelling Sangha and the forest Sangha. And there's always a kind of like a different lifestyle or different orientation or different, I guess, different attitude in those things. You know, I grew up in a forest tradition and I always kind of feel like a forest monk even though I've been living in the city for a while. But I don't know. I don't know whether that, what that makes me. It makes me someone who's still traveling. So right now I'm in between places. And I feel like, I don't know, I feel like there's an openness to this kind of journey or this way that we travel in samsara. There's a beautiful reflection in the opening of the Atadanda Sutta, and the Buddha's talking about like why he chose to go forth. Atadanda Sutta is in the Book of the Eights in the Sutta Nipata, and one of the most interesting and underrated suttas. Because it, like we're all, probably most of us are familiar with the story of how the Buddha went forth after seeing, or the Bodhisattva went forth after seeing the four sights. Is everyone familiar with that story? Yeah, the Bodhisattva kept at home, not allowed to see anything. He had his like Wi-Fi privileges revoked and... And Dad was like, no, no telly for you. And he couldn't see anything. And no sick people, no old people, only nice things. Until eventually he went out of the house and saw a sick person. And then on subsequent trips, an old person and a dead person. And had what today we would call an existential crisis. Went back to his palace and brooded. And was depressed and didn't know what to do because he thought, here I am stuck in this situation where everything is, everyone's going to die, everyone's going to get old, everyone's going to get sick. There's nothing I can do about it. This feeling of this kind of inevitability or this kind of crushing inevitability. But on the fourth trip out from the home, he saw a sadhu, a wandering mendicant of some sort. And it's kind of interesting that he found this inspiration in just that sight and just saying, oh, that's somebody who has that like belief or faith or even hope that there could be something else, that there could be an escape. And then he asked him and he said, well, I live a life of goodness and I live a life to try to practice a life of goodness to find freedom from suffering. And so that was what spurred him on. Now, of course, as from a text critical point of view, I will have to be a bit of a Debbie Downer. That's the main role of text critical studies. That story is not actually told of Gautama Buddha in the suttas. Okay, we do find that story in the suttas, but it is told of Vipassi Bodhisatta, one of the past Buddhas. Now, we can assume that something similar happened. Like, I don't necessarily think that it's meant to be literally true. It's obviously framed as a metaphorical thing or whatever. But that's a normal story which people will tell about the Buddha's going forth.
Wasn't it war that really propelled Buddha?
Good question. Sinsen asked, wasn't it war? Yes, that's what it says in the Atadanda Sutta. So the Atadanda Sutta gives another account of the Buddha's going forth. And as usual in the suttas, what we find is the account which is the most historically plausible and probably tells the Buddha's own story in his own words is virtually ignored and forgotten, whereas the one which was the later legend is universally repeated. Anyhow, so the Atadanda Sutta tells that Atadandang Bhayang Jatang, that fear is born from the taking up of arms. Yeah? And seeing danger and threats on every side, it became filled with a kind of sangwegang, some kind of agitation or like this emotional sort of feeling of being overwhelmed. And it's a really kind of interesting, quite subtle description of how he looked at every direction and he couldn't see any place that was not being tossed about. It's like a fish in a stream that's dried up. Yeah? Flopping about like a fish in a stream that's dried up. Then And you could see that people were wandering around to try to find some place that was, but everywhere was settled. And even in their settlements, then people would still fight. To me, that part is like really interesting. Right? We spend our time seeking for something which that's going to be it. You know, the holy land, the place, the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, or maybe just a nice apartment to live in on the river, or whatever it might be. And then you think, oh, now I'll be settled. But as soon as you're actually settled, then what do? People start fighting again. Strange, isn't it? And that feeling that contentment is just never to be found, and people running around all over the place. So the Buddha investigated and reflected and found that it was craving that was driving people across the land and across from place to place. So being the Buddha, of course, then these things have more than one dimension. So as well as talking about like a physical place in which to stay, then it also has a metaphorical application. So one of the explanations of that passage, it talks about how the place that we settle in, right, is really the eye and the ear and the nose and the tongue and the body and the mind. And these are places that we can also inhabit. These are like our homes. That's a very interesting, a very kind of suggestive metaphor. So we inhabit our eyes. Like when we see things, we see things from this perspective. Right? Everybody else sees things from another perspective, which means they're seeing something else, which means we don't actually share an objective reality. Really. I mean, kind of we do, but everybody sees things from a very different place, even if you're seeing the same thing. So that place from which we see sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch is something that we can inhabit and something that we can become attached to, like it's our own home or like it's our own house. And if because we identify it and we think of it as ours, we want to hold on to it, then, of course, it will change and it will lead to suffering because that's what happens with homes. There was a Thai monk called Aluk Jamnian who had the reputation of being able to see. I don't know if this is true or not. Okay, I'm just telling you the story. He had a reputation for being able to see, like, beings and so on and so forth. And many stories about Lumbur Jamnian people would tell, like with the time that he came to the airport and he was greeted by one of the Western monks in the airport in America. And Lumbur Jamnian's famous because he, apart from anything else, he would have a monk's vest with lots of pockets. And the pockets, in the pockets, we had lots of amulets, right? So like by wearing them, then they get supercharged. I don't know, whatever. And then he was also like one of these very handy monks who would like carry pliers and scissors and pocket knives and all of this kind of stuff in his vest as well, right? And if he was walking around his monastery and there was a leaking tap, he would always have a tool on hand, he'd fix it up, you know, that kind of thing, right? Thai monks generally are very practical like that, right? But Lumbur Jamnian was like that. So anyway, he would wear this vest all the time. And when he was greeted at the airport, the Western monk who was there to greet him, was quite shocked to see he just walked through the metal detector and it didn't even go bing. And he's like, what's going on? You're not wearing your vest. He said, no, here it is. He said, but the thing didn't go bing. He said, yeah. He said, how does that happen? He said, it's easy. You just like spread metta to everyone and walk through. I don't know. Try it and see. Try it and see. You may or may not get through the metal detector, but you will at least have metta. So that's all right. Anyway, so what was I saying? Oh, Lumbur Jamnian. Yeah, when he came back from America, then somebody said, what was America like? He said, so many hungry ghosts, full of hungry ghosts. Yeah. He said, they're so attached to their houses. So attached to their material things, and their relatives don't do any sharing of merit or anything like that for them. and they're not doing any merit in their lifetimes, and they're attached to their houses, so after they die, they hang around. Maybe this is why, like, everything's happening in the US. The hungry ghosts are, there's like the too many hungry ghosts, and it's just like, I don't know. But it's kind of an interesting observation, right, to think about like that, because the more that we build up those things, the more we have like big houses and nice places and all of those things, and the more then your mind gets attached to it. You can't really help it. So you have to try your best to overcome this, just as you try to overcome the attachment to sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch. I mean, look, monastics were living in nice places from the time of the Buddha. You know, it talks about this in the Vinaya. You know, it talks about what kind of building is allowable for monastics. And there was Buddha, the Sangha was offered the Migaramata Pasada, so a 7-story palace owned by the richest lady in Sarvati, right? And she offered this for the Sangha, and the Sangha used it, and the Buddha said that's okay. So the Sangha had nice places to stay in from the beginning. But also we are advised from the beginning, when we're ordained, that the basic requisite of for our accommodation is the root of a tree. Okay? So if we can have the root of a tree, then we should be content. Yeah, we should be happy. Actually, staying at the root of a tree is nice. Yeah? Actually, it's lovely. Yeah, as long as the weather's all right, the ground's not too rocky, right? But it's beautiful. There's actually something really energizing, really lovely about being able to do that, and to have very freeing about the thought that you can be content with just that much. So this is something that monastics still do. Not so often these days, but they'll still go out and wander. What in Thailand they call tudong, or in Sri Lanka, like the Pali word for it is charika, and wandering around the place, going through the forest. I think you can still do it in Sri Lanka quite well, but in Thailand it's a bit difficult. Some people still do. I spoke with a monk recently who was going for tudong around Thailand. But a friend of mine who was doing it a number of years ago said it's become a lot more difficult because they chopped down a lot of the forest. So a lot of the places which you, like if you read books by Ajahn Lee or Ajahn Chah or Ajahn Mun, and they'll talk about the places that they went to, then a lot of those places don't exist anymore, or they are resorts, or are developed in one way or another. So it's not so easy to just wander around. And I think that's generally true for all of us, is that we don't, it's just not so easy to find a place that is unsettled, find a place that is empty, find a place that has some freedom. You know, we share the planet with a lot of people. Right? When we think about like that abode, right? So I talked at the beginning of this talk, I sort of made a list of all the different places that I've lived in, all the different places I've stayed in. Which I guess is pretty average in terms of the number of places, I don't know. But of course, one thing that all those places do have in common is that they are all on planet Earth, right? Anybody here ever lived not on planet Earth? Don't think so. No astronauts here? And I'm not talking about those times taking those funny pills and traveling to the other side of the galaxy. Or anything like that. So we're all here on planet Earth, and so this is our home. This is our abode. We can wander around on the planet. But it's also, it's kind of amazing that we can even do that, right? I mean, it's the only place in the universe that we know of that you can do that. And you can only do it, like, in certain places and certain seasons for certain periods of time. And I know I talk about this a lot, but it's so important just to remember that everywhere else in the universe is like really bad. It's really impossible to overstate how bad everywhere else in the world is. If you think that like it was 39 degrees here in Sydney a couple of days ago, if you think 39 degrees is bad, try living on the surface of the sun. And it is a lot worse. Try living on Venus with sulfuric acid for rain. Try living on Mars. I mean, like Mars is like the best place. We think, oh yeah, we'll go to Mars. Like if we were to do all of the worst possible things we could to this Earth, right? Just imagine a hypothetical world where we chopped down all of the trees, where we polluted all of the oceans, where that's not a hypothetical world. So just imagine a hypothetical world where we just did everything possible, terrible, runaway climate change, even throw in a couple of massive thermonuclear wars and, you know, all of that stuff, as bad as you can possibly make it. Earth is still better than anywhere else. Still better. Yeah, even if we're living in like Mad Max, right? So you're living Mad Max, but without any petrol. So Mad Max on bicycles, okay? That's what the future. that's like gangs of roving bandits on their BMXs going across the desert, and that's the worst possible world you can imagine. It's still better than Mars. Oh, hell, still better than Mars, still better than anywhere else in the world. And if you want to find another good neighborhood to stay in, it's a long way. I checked, there's no buses there, right? And there's no, people have this idea, like I think we get it from science fiction, people have this idea that like traveling to other worlds is like an engineering problem. Like we'll just sort of figure out the kind of engine or kind of drive we're going to have, or a warp drive or a faster than light drive or something like that, and we'll be able to get to other worlds. I hate to break it to you, but the speed of light is not a suggestion. It is a hard limit, and it is exceedingly unlikely that we will ever travel anywhere in the universe to any other habitable planet other than this one. Exceedingly unlikely. So this is it, right? And just as we want to find contentment in our eyes and our ears and our nose and our tongue and our body and our mind, and we want to find contentment in the homes that we're living, we need to find contentment in this home that we're living in, the planet Earth, because there is not going to be another one anytime soon. So in the Dhamma, our home is our body with its senses, which experiences everything around us. And in this home, we can be content or we can be discontent. But if we are not content, right? Assuming hypothetically that we have some craving and attachments, okay? Then what happens, right? What happens is that we move home. That's what we call dying and being reborn. And it's kind of interesting when the Buddha talked about that process of rebirth, that he frequently used the metaphor of moving home. And in fact, like the word in Pali, one of the common words in Pali for past, what we would call past lives, is actually pubenivasa, which means previous abodes, is the literal translation, previous abodes. And the similes that the Buddha would use would be like the simile, say, like to watch somebody, people being reborn, would be to watch like somebody walking out of their house, walking down the street, and then walking into another house. Right? And so you have these kinds of metaphors of moving home as being like being reborn. I think that's actually a really interesting metaphor to consider. Okay, so let's just think about that for a minute. First of all, if we think about that, then we can compare it to like moving house in this life. So we can realize, oh, yeah, it's probably as disturbing and like has that similar quality that you leave stuff behind. Like when you move from one place to another, you leave things behind, right? All right. I think like modern moving, the main practice is that you take with you the things that you need, as well as all of the boxes of stuff that you brought from your last home that you haven't unpacked yet. So they come with you then to your next place. And that's, yeah, you kind of do that. But ideally, you shed things. So when we reach the end of this life, we shed things. And you don't get to take stuff with you, okay? Shall I make a list of all the things you don't take with you? You don't take your nice crockery, okay? You don't get to take that sofa that's really comfy. You do not get to take your car and your any of those things. What you get to take is your karma. That's it. Okay? So how you've lived in this life is going to determine what's going to happen to you in the next life. That's it. Everything else is gone. All of your loved ones are gone. All of your accomplishments left behind. All of the monuments to your name, assuming you have monuments to your name, left behind. That's it. That's it. Just your karma driving your consciousness to a new abode. Now, in the Buddhist traditions, they have different opinions about whether this happens instantaneously or whether it happens over a long period of time. Now, traditionally in Theravada, the accepted doctrine is that it happens instantaneously. You go from one life to another, a bit like walking from one room to another, right? You step from one room to another, there's nothing in between. And that was discussed first in the Katawattu, which is a Pali Abhidhamma text that discusses the different interpretations of teachings among Buddhist schools. Most Buddhist schools, however, accepted like a period of transition from one life to another called an antara bhava. And the suttas are not entirely like explicit about this. Usually you find that in cases where there are controversies among the schools, that usually it's because it's not actually sort of stated explicitly in the suttas. So there's room for interpretation there. But there are a number of passages in the suttas that seem to indicate that the Buddha did in fact talk about an in-between state. And a couple of them are quite, I think, fairly unambiguous in nature. But then people say, like, how long does it take and these kinds of things. Well, I think using the analogy of moving home is actually quite good because you ask, well, how long does it take to move home? Well, it depends, right? Depends, do you have the financing? What's in the new place? What's the old place? Where is it? How do you get moved? And actually, it doesn't happen all at once. It's not a moment, right? So I went today to my new place and they gave me a key. Is that the moment that I've moved in? But my stuff's still at my old place, right? The electricity isn't on there. Is it like, when is the actual moment, right? Is it the moment when all those things are there? Is it the moment, I don't know, is it the moment when you feel at home? Is it the moment when you sleep there for the first time, perhaps? The reality is it's actually just a convention. It's a process. And I think the process of taking new life is like that. And I don't think that, which has a number of implications. Like, I don't think, sorry, there's just some noise here. Sounds like someone decided to do some home renovations on Friday night. Anyway. So I don't think the process of rebirth happens all at once, which I think has some interesting consequences. Like I think, like, sometimes we talk about, like, when is the time of conception, right? And when is the time that a new being is actually born? I don't actually think that there's a moment there. Like, if you look at it biologically, it's obviously a process, and it's a process which is drawn out over, you know, a period of time when you can say, well, you know, at this point it's, you know, just a cell, and then it's two cells, and then it's growing, and it's three. And then after a time, then, well, it's a baby. But there's no, like, one sort of defining point between that you can say that's one thing or the other necessarily. And so in the same thing, I think, with moving home, there's not necessarily one defining point, which suggests a number of things. For a start, it suggests that there's a difference in the amount of attachment that you have and therefore in the amount of suffering that you have, right? So I think, again, I'm thinking about the process of rebirth. Like, if you're thinking of moving home, right, then you go and visit a place, right? You think, oh, yeah, this place would be good, right? So you've started the process of moving home just by thinking it, right? And then you talk to the estate agent, and the estate agent says, oh, we've got another offer, right? Well, you probably feel mild disappointment, right? And go on and do the next one, right? And so then maybe the stage goes further. Maybe the estate agent says, oh, this is good, and you arrange these things, and you go to the bank to get the loan, and the bank manager says, no, this is too much, we're not going to give you that loan. Oh, well, you're going to feel even more disappointment, right? And at each step, the more that you go there, the more hassle it is, right? Like, so for me now, if I was to be told, no, I can't go to my new place, I would be an emotional wreck. I would be a mess. I'd be like, no, please, let me in my new house. I don't know, maybe, anyway. But the longer you stay there, then the more attached you're going to get there. Get to the new place. I kind of think that's the case with, like, when you get reborn as well. Like, I think at the first stages of that process, you're probably lightly attached to that new birth. And if there's a miscarriage or if there's an abortion or something like that, then you know, in the Mahanidana Sutra, it talks about this, use the word vachajissata. Like, if that developing embryo becomes cut off, then goes to a new rebirth. So if that happens in those initial stages, like, the longer it goes on, the more embedded and attached the consciousness is to the new life. So the more suffering there's going to be to going on, which kind of suggests, has some implications in terms of, like, how we think about the ethics of abortion and so on. It certainly goes against the idea. Like, I think that abortion is something that should be considered ethically seriously, but I don't think that, I think it's reductive and harmful to take the absolutist approach taken by many Christians these days to equate even very early stage abortion with murder. And I think that this is extremely harmful, actually. So, I don't want to sort of talk too much about that particular ethical issue, but there is, I think, a relevance to that process of moving home. Anyway, so we move home, we get established, we're fixated in our new life. Oh, by the way, I don't know if I mentioned this, did I mention this some time ago, that the Buddha in the suttas, there's a detailed mention of the four early stages of embryonic development in the womb, 1 week per stage, which correspond exactly with the stages as recognized in modern medicine. I didn't mention that. Awesome. Incredible. Like, how does that happen? It's not like the embryo is, like, too small to even see at that point, right? And this is I'm not even kind of messing around. Like, the suttas gives a list of different stages, and the commentary says each stage is 1 week each. Same in modern medicine, like, with the different early stages of development, is 1 week each. And the names of them, like, you have the modern name, one of those stages is called the blastocyst, because the embryo is embedded on the wall of the uterus. And then that the Pali word for that stage is a cyst, right? Right? It's not just an approximate similarity. It's, like, literally describing the same stages from in that, yeah. So that's in the Samyutta Nikaya, in the Sagata Wagga, yeah. Okay.
7 days
of stages
of the development.
Okay, yeah. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, ancient Indian medical science was very advanced. We know that. You know, they can, the Vinaya talks about people doing brain surgery successfully, right? So we know that the Ayurvedic science was very advanced, but still, though. Anyway.
So the Buddha says that rebirth takes place, like, on the first week or at any point,
Yeah, so the question was, did the Buddha say that rebirth takes place at the first week or at any point? So the suttas don't really kind of specify a particular point, but they talk about, like, the growth of nama rupa and vijnana, like the growth of the embryo and so on. So there's not like the suttas aren't really explicit talking about that first point as such. Yeah.
And didn't mention about consciousness and when it's
consciousness and when it's in it, right? So again I would look at that from that metaphor of moving home, right? So your consciousness in that case is like your attachment to the new place, and you say, well, when is your attachment to that new place? Well, it grows over a period of time. Yeah. Again another simile that the Buddha would give for that is like planting a seed. Right, so you plant a seed and say, well, when is the seed planted? Is it when you put it in the soil? Okay, but it's just like sitting in the soil, you know. And if you leave that seed, like the longer you leave that seed, the more deeply and more securely it's planted. So if you move it after a day or two, it's probably not going to really matter. But if you leave it for a long, the longer you leave it, then the more you're going to damage it in trying to move it. So again, if we think of it in terms of an organic process like that, I think we're going to be better rather than seeing it in terms of like absolute black and white. Yeah. The absolute black and white way of seeing it really comes from a Christian theology where you have not even just like, yeah, I don't even think like necessarily mainstream Christian theology, but from a particular kind of Christian theology where you have like a soul which is either present or not present. So yourself is that soul, and that soul is either there or it's not there. So if and Christians have historically not been particularly consistent about this. So a lot of them, it's still like, do animals have souls? Right. So if animals don't have souls, then they don't have any, they're not worthy of any, deserving of any moral consideration, according to this particular theory. Most Christians effectively don't necessarily really believe this. Okay. Like, I don't know any personally, any Christians who would say that animals have no worth. It doesn't matter what you do to them, right? They, in practice, they believe that. But theologically, it's complicated. Of course, women, right? Also, no souls. According to many Christian theologians, right? Again, I'm not saying this is a kind of a mainstream Christian view these days, but it's just, I'm just, the idea is about how arbitrary this is, right? That we can say who gets to have a soul and therefore has moral worth and who doesn't. I think it's a very it's a very kind of top-down metaphysical way of thinking about it, rather than, again, the Buddhist way of thinking about it is very organic in terms of growth and relationship and connection. Yeah. Anyway, okay. So I'm at the moment inhabiting a certain antarabhava, in-between state. I'm neither in one place nor the other, but kind of in both, but also kind of neither. So I'll be like that for a while. And then I'll be in my new place. So then that something else will happen. Who knows? Yeah. I will try not to get too attached to it.
It's very interesting,
because
antara means between in
Indonesian. Right. Sanskrit, yeah. Yeah, antara bhava, yeah, the in-between state, yeah.
Is it probably equivalent to the bardo state?
So in Tibetan tradition, they talk about the bardo state, as Sinsin was just asking. So bardo state is very similar, but the bardo, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, has a detailed description of that process. Actually, it draws on various Indian texts. So one of the things that you find in Indian Buddhism, because in Theravada, the Theravadins didn't accept the antarabhava. But they still had various descriptions about what happens at that time of rebirth. So, for example, like you'd have like a nimitta, like a sign or a vision that would appear, and different kinds of signs or visions might appear to someone at the time of death. Sometimes it's the vision of the kamma, which is going to be effective for you at the time of death, right? So that might happen, for example, if you have like a guilty conscience. Yeah. And then you have at the time of death, you remember that bad thing that you did. And then, oops, yikes. So that's one thing. Or you might have like what they call a gati nimitta, which is a vision of the destiny, the place that you're going to go to. So these again, according to the Theravadin tradition, these are things that people on the deathbed can sometimes see. And then, you know, sometimes people might call out or cry out and say, oh, you know, no, don't take me, or something like that, depending on what's going to happen. In other traditions that did accept the in-between state, such as the Sarvastivadins, they developed a more complex theory about what actually happened in that state and like what that journey through that state was. And that was then taken up by the Tibetans and then extended in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. But it's really based on some of the Sarvastivadin and Mula Sarvastivadin scriptures, which are kind of interesting. For example, they have an Oedipus complex there. Like that's right there from not just when you're growing up, like Freud said, but from when you're born. When you in the in-between state, you see your parents having sex and you have desire for the mother and anger to the father, or jealousy to the father, or vice versa, depending. Yeah, and then that impulse then drives your conception.
Sounds very
very what says
and, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. That's in a more sort of a Sivadin text called the Sadharma Smitupasthana Sutra, and it seems to have influenced the Tibetan Book of the Dead. What happens with IVF? Oh, you're in that in between stage. You see that? You see those test tubes? You're like, ooh. Everybody's got something, you know. If it's frozen, yeah. Like I said, everyone's got something. Like. So look, I don't know. I mean, it is kind of interesting though, right? It is interesting, like in you know, modern times, and we do intervene in that process and in various kinds of ways. So, you know, how that kind of manifests in terms of karma, in terms of consciousness and these kinds of things. Yeah, it's interesting. But again, I would, you know, would just say, you know, I think that there are different ways of reflecting about these things according to Dhamma. But I would say, you know, just to, when doing so, always bear that in mind that, you know, to think about it in those organic ways, right? And in terms of like organic growth and so on. And you think about, you know, even just like the way that life works, right? I mean, in you know, we've changed everything about how life works in these places. Like we're in Sydney here, you know, it's completely different environment than before white people came. And obviously a lot of devastation for wildlife and so on. But then we've got our bin chickens who are thriving, right? And this is the ibis, right? And in ancient Egyptian pantheon, these were like the Thoth, the guardian and the guide to the river of the dead, and we call them bin chickens. The sacred ibis, yeah. And the bush turkeys, which are awesome, made a huge comeback in Sydney in the last 5 to 10 years.
Right? Yes.
You never used to see them, you know, like I think probably 20 years ago, and then 10 years ago you started to see them, and then now they're everywhere. So they really made a comeback. I mean, apparently the reason why is because they're quite delicious. Apparently. So when the settlers first came, they just ate them all.
Oh, the bush
things?
Yeah. Oh, okay.
I mean, yum, right? I mean, you didn't have KFC in those days, so that was the best you could have. And, yeah, so they basically got, you know, exterminated in the Sydney area. And but, yeah, recently they're making a comeback. Anyway. All right, so we've covered quite a lot of ground today, from the life of the Buddha to bush turkeys and Oedipal complexes and anywhere in between. So that's the nature of samsara for you. Yes. Anyway, thanks everybody for joining with me for this somewhat rambling talk this evening. Bodhi said, just a couple of the comments here on the chat. Some of them are not worth reading out loud. Thanks everybody. I love you all. No, people are cracking jokes on the thing. Okay, we're going chicken before the egg theory. Okay, so Bodhi says that the egg came before the chicken because egg-laying reptiles appeared on the planet before feathered creatures. Thank you so much for resolving that time-honored problem for us. So was there no soul back then, right? If there was no humans, then there were no souls. But we all know that the earth was created in 4000 BC, so that's that problem. Dinosaurs were invented as a conspiracy theory. Anyway, again, I just want to say, like, you know, I made those remarks about Christianity and souls. In fact, like, if you look in the Bible, it doesn't really say anything about souls and all of those kinds of metaphysical stuff at all. And, you know, if you listen to, you know, most Christians for practical purposes don't really think about these things a lot. And, you know, personally, I think it's probably likely most Christians would be quite happy to say, yeah, of course animals have souls or whatever. So I'm not trying to vilify Christians and say that they believe that. I'm just saying that certain theologians have these metaphysical ways of seeing it, which can drive some people's ethical perceptions as well. So Sumana asks, what's the closest Pali word that could describe the soul with all of its soul calling, soul inclination, anusaya, or dark night of the soul? So first of all, thank you, Sumana, for asking a sensible question at last, yes. the closest Pali word is soul, yeah. So in English, when we talk about a soul, we have sort of everyday meanings of it, right? So you say like a musician plays with soul or something like that, as well as a metaphysical sense, right? So when the Buddha talked about no self or no soul, we're talking about the metaphysical sense. There's a few words that might be a bit similar to that, like a word like jeto, sometimes we translate as heart, is a little bit similar to that. The word atta or the self sometimes has those kind of overlaps with those kinds of meanings of soul as well. Yeah. Jiva is a word for soul especially in the Jain tradition, but it's not really used in that same kind of sense. Like it's only used, as far as I know, really only used in that sense anyway. All right. Chitta in some cases can overlap with a sense of soul in that kind of colloquial sense, yes. All right, so thanks everybody. And just a reminder that our robe offering ceremony, aka Katina, is tomorrow. And also a reminder, the Metta Convention, Many Rivers, One Ocean, 8th and 9th of November, 2025, Western Sydney Uni, Bankstown, and put on by our good friends at the Metta Centre. So get your ticket, come along.
Your title is What Stories Will You Tell?
My title is What Stories Will You Tell? Is that right?
Yeah.
So that's what I am now. Instead of Bhante Sujata, I'm What Stories Will You Tell Sujata?
The title of your talk.
The title of the talk. Oh, okay. That's more convenient anyway. Okay, fine. Okay, what stories will you tell, yeah? Okay. So it'll be great to, always with these things, you know, it's really nice to catch up with old friends, meet new friends, see some of the visiting teachers and so on, and exchange ideas. So it's always a very fertile time. And we will be doing a large Sangha Pindabat in Harris Park. So there'll be 10 monastics coming to Harris Park. 15 monastics now? Okay. 15 monastics. And what's the date on that again?
The 10th, the day after the Metta Convention.
The day after the Metta Convention. So that's on the 10th of November. We'll have 15 monastics going for Pindabhata in Harris Park. Okay. So if you're in Sydney, then do come along to Harris Park on that day because there'll be a lot of hungry Sangha. No, it'll be awesome. It'll be a great opportunity. So we'll go for the Pindabhata on Harris Park, and we'll then have the meal together in the Rosella Park just there. So we'll have a picnic with the community. So, yes, anything else that needs mentioning for now? I think that's good enough for now. Thanks, everybody. Look forward to seeing you back here next Friday, and also don't forget Wednesday night, 7 o'clock at Crow's Nest. So see you then. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.